scripture reading for this evening is taken from the book of Genesis, chapter 37, verses 1 through 3. That's Genesis 37, 1 through 3. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors.
When God says something is going to be done, it is as good as done. In fact, in the timeless realm of heaven, it's already done. That explains some of the prophecies, such as David in Psalm 16 saying, "You will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of joy in your presence." Some of that's in the future tense. Some of it seems to be in the past tense, because in God's mind, it's already done. And it was speaking about the resurrection of Christ that would come some 1,000 years after that was written. God planned from before the foundation of the world a plan to get us to Christ. We've seen that unfold a little bit in the book of Genesis. Adam and Eve were placed in the garden. Sin then entered into the garden, and the promise was made that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the seed of the serpent. Wickedness overcame the world, and the flood came, and after that, Shem, one of the sons of Noah, had offspring that led down all the way to Terah, and then to Abraham. Abraham had Isaac. Isaac had Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons, one of whom was by the wife he really loved, and that was Joseph. There are going to be a couple problems in Israel's history to come up. With that plan in mind, don't you think the devil would just want to stop Christ coming into the world at any point that he could, stop the lineage that God planned, stop the Jewish people, put them out of existence so that Christ would never get here? Don't you think that would be Satan's plan? Well, it was. A lot of the stories of the Old Testament that we know and love, I think, fit into a category that could be called crises in the lineage of Christ. There were crises that were going to wipe out the Jewish people. There were crises that were going to keep us from getting to, in history, the Christ. One of those was the flood. What if God had wiped out everybody and stopped the world before Christ ever came? Then anybody who lived morally well before the flood wouldn't have had a chance of heaven. And what if God had wiped out everyone at some point prior to Christ's coming, even after the flood? Then nobody would have had any hope, and there would be no population of God's crown creation, human beings, in heaven. There's going to be a famine that would come upon Jacob's family, his 12 sons and their wives and their children, as they're dwelling in the promised land of Canaan. That famine would wipe out a lot of people that were there. And there were going to be some other problems that they had to avoid. There was going to be a family problem that would threaten the lineage of Christ. Also, there was a prediction that God's people, the Israelites, would not be allowed to really inhabit that land for some 400 years after Abraham. In the fourth generation, some 400 years later, Genesis 15, verse 16, until the iniquity of the Amorites was complete. So how's God going to work all that out? He's going to work through people. He's going to work through their good choices. He's going to work through some of their bad choices. But he's going to work. Joseph was 17 years old when he started to have dreams. He also was the favorite son of his father, and that's not good for parents to play favorites, but Jacob / Israel did it. And that made his brothers very jealous. His father made him a coat of many colors, and that made his brothers very jealous. Then he had a dream. God could work through dreams. Sometimes God worked directly in miracles. Sometimes God worked behind the scenes without any kind of evidence. And sometimes, every once in a while, as is the case of Daniel and Joseph, He gave somebody dreams and he gave somebody the ability to interpret dreams, but he still didn't do anything outwardly, overtly miraculous. God gave Joseph dreams, one of which had sheaves in the field representing him and his brothers, and all the other sheaves rose up and then bowed down to Joseph's sheaf. He told his brothers that, and they didn't like it real well. You think we're going to bow down to you? I mean, I didn't have any brothers, but I had a couple of sisters, and if they ever thought I was going to bow down to them, they would have had another thing coming. And then Joseph has another dream that the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to him. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, "You think that your mother and I and your brothers are all going to bow down to you?" One day, the brothers were off in Shechem feeding flocks, and Jacob sent Joseph to check on the brothers. As they saw him coming, they plotted to kill him. But one or two of them had a little bit more cool on their heads. Reuben, in particular, said, "Let's not kill him. Let's just throw him into this pit, and we'll sell him to some people that come by." Reuben's real plan was to come back and get Joseph when the brothers weren't looking and save him. They put Joseph in the pit, and they sit down to eat, and the Ishmaelite traders come by. Remember Abraham and Hagar and Ishmael? The Ishmaelite traders come by, and they decide to make a profit off Joseph. They sell him to the Ishmaelite traders. Judah wonders what's happened to him. He's not in the pit anymore, and they tell him that sold him, and he's gone, and then they try to figure out what they're going to do about this for their father, so they figure that deception is best, get the hurt over with quickly. They kill a kid of the goats, take the blood of the goat, and put it on Jacob's robe of many colors, or Joseph's robe of many colors, show it to the father and say, "See, he's been torn up by a wild animal." They couldn't run any DNA tests in those days, so Jacob took him at their word. It sure looked pretty good. It sure looked like that was the obvious conclusion, and Jacob mourned. He had two sons only by Rachel, his beloved wife. You remember, he worked 7 years for Rachel, and then he got Leah instead by Laban's trickery. And then he had sons by Zilpah and Bilhah, their handmaids. And then finally, in his old age, he gets Joseph, and then he gets Benjamin. And Rachel dies while giving birth to Benjamin. He's lost Joseph, his favorite son, the one that he loved, the one that he loved so dearly. He thinks he's dead, but really he's still alive. They sell him to these Ishmaelite traders, these Midianite traders, who take him down into Egypt and sell him to a man named Potiphar, who is the captain of the guard for Pharaoh, who is the ruler of all of the civilized world at that time, as civilized as you might call it. In chapter 38, there's a segue from that because there's another crisis. God was going to promise later that the Christ would come through Judah's lineage. He hadn't exactly promised that yet, but God, you see, has things planned out in purpose. Well, here was the problem. Chapter 38, it gets kind of sordid. Judah had three sons, Onan, and Shelah. God killed because he was wicked. And then Judah took Ur's wife and gave her to Onan so that Onan would raise up children by her to save Ur's name. Onan committed his own sort of ancient birth control, enjoying the pleasure but not taking part in the responsibility. And that was wicked in God's sight because of not having the baby to raise up to and God killed him. Shelah was kind of young at that time, and so Judah said to Tamar, the wife, "Just wait for him." Tamar sees that the longer she waits, the older Shelah gets, that she's not going to get him. Maybe Judah is afraid to give him to her because he's lost two sons already. Maybe in his superstitious mind he thinks there's a reason behind it for that. So Tamar decides to play a little trick. She goes to a place where she dresses herself as a harlot. Judah goes there and has the mood to go into a harlot that night. Judah offers some payment for her services. He doesn't have that payment with him, so she says, "What can I take as a sign that you'll give me this payment?" And he gives her a couple of his precious items as a sign, his signet and his cord, to ensure that she will be paid. He goes into her, his daughter-in-law, and she conceives. When he gets back home, some people come to him and they say, your daughter-in-law Tamar is pregnant. And he says she ought to be killed for that harlotry. And then she shows him the things that he gave her, says, I'm with child by the owner of these. So he lets her live, and she eventually has twins. Zerah comes out first, and the handmaid puts a little cord on the finger of Zerah, but then he goes back in, and somehow Perez comes out next, and that solves a problem in the crisis of the genealogy of Christ. If you look at Matthew chapter 1, verse 3, you will see that Judah, in the genealogy of Christ, had Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez begot Ram, and Ram begot Aminadab, and Aminadab begot Nahshon, and Nahshon begot Salmon, and Salmon begot Boaz, and Boaz begot Obed, and Obed begot Jesse, and Obed begot David, the king, who would be the forefather of the Christ. So one problem is solved, but we still have this lineage thing to deal with. So in chapter 39, we're back to the story of Joseph. He has risen up in Potiphar's house to be in charge of all of Potiphar's house, his estate, his management, because the Lord was with him. The Lord blessed him for his good work. But Potiphar's wife was not a pure woman. She saw a young, handsome man in Joseph and tried day after day after day after day to seduce him, but he resisted day after day after day after day until finally she caught him in the room and grabbed his coat. And he was so desperate to get away from her, he literally followed 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18, before it was written, flee sexual immorality, that he ran out of that house without his coat. She, to cover herself, accused him of attempted rape, and he was put in prison unfairly. He's been sold into slavery unfairly. He's been put into prison unfairly. In prison, he works, he's faithful, he does his job. And so the captain of the prison or the jailer puts him in charge of everything in the prison and trusts him to do his work. More dreams come along the way. A butler and a baker of Pharaoh inspired the king's wrath at them, and they were thrown into prison. After a while, they had dreams. The butler had a dream that there were three vines and they were growing grapes, and he took some of the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup. And when Joseph interpreted the dream, he says, that means that in 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and you'll be restored to your position. The baker said, I also had a dream. There were three baskets on my head, and in the uppermost basket, all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds were coming and eating the baked goods. And Joseph said, that means that in 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and hang you, and the birds will eat your flesh. When he spoke to the butler, the one who would be restored, he said, when you get to Pharaoh, please remember me. Please tell him about me. I'm in prison unjustly. Please do something. They didn't have the lawyers coming to visit the prisoners in the secluded rooms. They didn't have an ACLU. They didn't have an appeals process. Please tell him about me to get me out of this dungeon. The baker died the way Joseph predicted, and the butler got restored to his position, but he forgot him for 2 years. Pharaoh finally then had some dreams in which seven ugly and gaunt cows were in the field in the meadow, and there were seven fine-looking and fat cows, but the ugly and gaunt cows ate the fine-looking and fat cows and were still ugly and gaunt. And then there were heads of grain that were full and plump, but there were heads of grain that were blighted by the east wind. Those heads that were blighted by the east wind ate the full and the plump ones, and still looked blighted. Nobody knew what to do about these dreams. The magicians in all of Egypt could not understand them. They couldn't predict them. They couldn't tell what was going on with these dreams. But the butler remembered Joseph, and they got Joseph out of prison, shaved him, cleaned him up, brought him before Pharaoh. He told him his dreams, and Joseph interpreted them. He said, there will be 7 years of great plenty. The crops are just going to be overflowing in Egypt for 7 years. And then after that, there will be 7 years of famine. What you ought to do, king, is find somebody that's wise, find somebody that's a good manager, and put him in charge of all the food. And for those 7 years of plenty, let him save some of the leftovers so that your empire can survive the 7 years of famine. Pharaoh said, I see nobody around better than you, Joseph. So Joseph was raised to second in command in all the world. After patiently wading through the pit The sale, Potiphar's household, the false accusation, the prison, the forgetfulness of the butler. Now finally, he's raised to a position of luxury and power and great responsibility for all the world. Well, he taxes the people. There is 1/5 of the grain that is supposed to be put into the grain storehouses in Egypt. There have been different bins that have been discovered that people have suggested might be the grain storehouses of Egypt. I'm not worried about finding those things. I know it's true because it's in the Bible. But he stored those things, and those 7 years of great plenty came, and then the 7 years of famine started, and the story shifts back to the land of Canaan, where Joseph's father and brothers are. People there are starving. They didn't have a wise king that was telling them to save things. They are in famine, and everybody around and all the countries around are going to Pharaoh begging for food, asking for food, asking that the breadbasket of the world feed them. Jacob sends the sons off to Egypt and says, "Go and see if there's any food for us there." When they get there, they appear, quite ironically, before their brother Joseph. Joseph recognizes them, but they don't recognize Joseph. It's all Joseph can do to control himself from his weeping, maybe from some other emotions. They ask for food. He asks about their family. He finds out that they have a father back home, as he suspected. He finds out they have a younger brother back home, Benjamin. And he says, "What you have to do is leave one of you here, go back home, bring your younger brother here, and then I'll know that you're not spies." He puts them in jail for 3 days to think about it. Then he doesn't really give them a choice. He takes Simeon and binds him, puts him in jail. He fills up their sacks with grain, puts their money in their sacks, unbeknownst to them. They start traveling back home, wondering what they're going to do because they've failed their father. They've lost another brother. They already had sold Joseph into slavery and told their father that he was dead. Now these brothers have lost another brother to prison, and they don't know what to do about it. On the way home, one of them opens his sack, and he finds his money in there, so they're scared to death. They're going to think we didn't pay for this. How did our money get in here? If we ever go back for food, they're going to punish us for being thieves. And they all find the money in the sack. They get back home to their father, and they tell him what's happened. And he's quite unpleased. They want to go back and get some more food. They start running out of food. They want to go back and get some more food. Jacob says, "Go back and get some more food." And they say, "We can't. We won't. Because the man said, don't come back without your younger brother." So Jacob delays as long as he can until, I suppose, hunger sets in. And then in chapter 43, he finally relents and lets them go back to see Joseph to get some more food, try to recapture Simeon, and lets them take Benjamin with him. They come, and they come to the servant of the household first. The servant of the household is one who meets their apologies. "We don't know how this money got here. We are sorry about this. We gave the money. We don't know what's going on." The servant says, "Don't worry about it. God put that money in your sacks. I had your money here all along." Apparently some kind of fib, unless there had been some kind of miracle. And then the man brought Joseph's brothers to him. He lifted his eyes, chapter 43, verse 29, and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." His heart yearned so much for his brother that Joseph made haste and got out of there and sought somewhere private to weep. He cleaned himself up after weeping and came back, fed them all dinner, and sent them on their way again with more food. But this time, he told the steward to put in Benjamin's sack Joseph's cup, the cup that he used for divination. Now, divination was something that was an abomination to God, always was, always will be. Sorcery, trying to predict the future, that sort of thing. I don't know if Joseph actually used it for divination or Pharaoh gave it to him for that purpose and he just looked like it. Joseph will claim later on when he comes back Actually, the guys go on the way. Joseph says, send a steward out there to accuse them of stealing my cup. They say, we didn't steal your cup. You find somebody that has your cup, you can kill him. And they find the cup in Benjamin's sack. And when they bring him back, he says, did you not know that this was my cup with which I practiced divination? It was a special cup for some reason. Joseph had married in the land Potipharah, the daughter of the priest of On. The daughter of Potiphar, the priest of On, had a couple sons by her, Manasseh and Ephraim. So the Egyptians are now in the lineage of Israel, if you will. When they get back and they appear, finally, Joseph tells his brothers who they are, who he is. And they become quite afraid. Can you imagine? Several years ago, maybe 20, 30 years ago, you sold your brother into slavery. You figure he's dead by now for real, or you figure he's lost to history by now. And you've come and you've stood before him twice now, and he says, I'm your brother you sold into slavery, and he's the second most powerful man in the world. What's he going to do to us? Chapter 45, verse 4, Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. So they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, watch this, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. What a heart of forgiveness. Don't be upset about selling me to bring me here. Why? Next phrase. For God sent me before you to preserve life. Joseph attributes his being sold into slavery, his being falsely accused of rape, his being put into prison, his being left there for 2 years by a forgetful butler, his rise to power in Egypt, all of that he attributes to God putting him in power of the food to save his brothers and all the family of Israel before they would become extinct. He goes on in verse 6, for these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Then he says, go get my father and bring him down here. Go get the rest of the family and bring him down here. Eventually they would. They would go back. They would have carts that he sent for them for travel. He sent the U-Haul brigade with them and said, move everybody down here. There were about 70 of them in all that would move from Canaan, and all the Israelites would move down to the land of Egypt, live in the best of the land of Goshen. Joseph would continue to collect food from the rest of the world, make Pharaoh rich, and Joseph and his family would prosper in that land. Jacob got to see his son again. When he first heard that his son was still alive, the Bible says his heart stood still. When they finally got to see each other again, they hugged and they wept. Jacob came down and he grew old in the land of Egypt. He told his sons, I want you to bury me back in the land of Canaan, back in my homeland. Before he died, he did something that was a little bit different, a little bit unique, but not in God's era. Remember how Zerah was really going to be the firstborn of the twins, but Perez ended up coming out first? Remember how Esau was the firstborn, but Jacob ended up being the one with the birthright and the blessing? God is the kind of person that turns the world upside down. If you want to be great in his kingdom, be servant of all. You think the King of Kings is going to be sitting on a throne? No, he's going to be born in a lowly town and be raised in a little area of a barn and serve as a carpenter. God's the kind of person that turns things upside down. So Jacob, when he's old, has Joseph bring his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, to him. Ephraim's on his left, Manasseh's on his right, if I remember correctly. The right hand would give the blessing. The left hand would give the secondary approval. Jacob crosses his hands to lay his hand on the second born first. Joseph tries to stop him, but he does it on purpose. And he gives the blessing to Ephraim. God continues to reverse things. Then, in Genesis chapter 49, Jacob gives his last words to his sons. He tells something about their character in these words. He tells some things about some things that they've done and some blessings or curses that will come upon them after that. In the midst of it is the great messianic prophecy concerning Judah. Starting at verse 8, Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, who shall rouse him? You remember in the book of Revelation that the lamb that takes the scroll out of the hand of the one on the throne is also called the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. The scepter, that's the ruling item, the rod that says, I'm the king. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, that is, being birthed to his family, until Shiloh comes, a peace name for the Christ, and to him shall be the obedience of his people. It's great messianic prophecy telling us that Christ would come in the lineage of Judah. Jacob dies. Joseph petitions Pharaoh, and they take Jacob back to the land of Canaan, where there's great mourning for him. 40 days among the Jews, if I remember correctly, and 70 days among the Egyptians. During this time in Egypt, in the land of Goshen, Jacob had endeared himself as some sort of public figure to the Egyptians. The Israelites had endeared themselves to the nation of Egypt, even though it was an abomination for the Egyptians to eat with them, we find out at one point. Somehow, through this time, after those 70 people moved down here, and the Israelite nation is saved before it would be destroyed by famine, and so the lineage of Christ is saved before the crisis actually really got too much, they had endeared themselves to him. But they go up and bury Jacob, and they come back, and then at the end of the book, Joseph dies, gives instructions that his bones would be taken up to the land of Canaan when they go there. The book of Exodus opens some 400 years later, reminding us of the 70 persons who had gone down into Egypt. Those 70 persons, probably, we don't have a biblical number, but probably by this time numbered a couple of million. There arose a Pharaoh, a new king, chapter 1, verse 8, who did not know Joseph. A new leadership forgot him, forgot the favor toward his people, and just became afraid that the Israelites would overcome them, overwhelm them, raise enough sons to embattle them and win the battle. I think you know what happens from there. God watches out for his people. God had a plan, and nothing was going to stop that plan. Now, God leaves me free will. I can choose whether to follow him or not. But I ought to know this, that if I choose to follow him, if I choose to confess my faith in Jesus as the Son of God, if I choose to repent of my sins, and if I choose to be baptized for the remission of my sins, and if I choose to live faithfully, then I can rely on God's promises. Promises that say if I walk in the light, God will forgive me as I stumble. He'll cleanse me from my sins as long as I repent and confess them. Promises that there is laid before me a glorious place called heaven where there's no more sorrow or crying or tears. Promises that all the bad things that happen in this world, such as happened to Joseph, can work together for good. Romans chapter 8, verse 28. I ought to be able to trust in God's promises with my free will, because when God says something is going to be done, it's going to be done. And maybe I ought to learn a little patience. What Joseph had to go through to get his family down to Egypt land. And he didn't even know it was going on because God was working through his providence. What are you going through now that you don't see a good end? You don't see anything good happening, but you get on your knees and you pray. God has power. somehow, for the faithful, it'll work out in the end. Maybe not in this world, but for the faithful, it'll work out in the end. If we could help you tonight, would you please come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you? Have you been to-